Mark Caro, and we've reached episode 150 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. To mark this milestone, we're doing something different. My friend Steve Dawson, an awesome singer-songwriter who was my guest back on episode 10 in December 2021, said he wanted to turn the tables and interview me for an episode. Of course, I deflected that I should be talking to him about his excellent new album, Ghosts, out now on Pravda Records. But he said, no, it's my turn. Steve and I have much experience talking with each other about our work and shared love of music. I took a songwriting class at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music, and the two of us wound up writing a book together, called Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You. It's meant to inspire and encourage your creativity, and more than half the book consists of Steve and me in dialogue about every aspect of songwriting that we could think of. Before then, I wrote about Steve's bands Dolly Varden and Stump the Host for the Chicago Tribune, and I've remained a big fan of his work with them and as a solo artist. So we've talked a lot, but I'm usually asking the questions, which is generally how I like it. I didn't start this podcast to hear myself talk. I'd much rather listen to more interesting, talented people share their stories and insights. But hey, Steve was curious about what led me to launching and hosting Caro Pop, so here's another conversation between us, and you get to listen. We talk about curiosity as a driving force, the keys to interviewing celebrities and other creative people, how my math science brain may factor into my work, how Caro Pop became so music-focused, and why talking about art is more satisfying than talking about sales and careers. Paul McCartney, John Travolta, and Cuba Gooding Jr. may make cameo appearances. I always enjoy talking with Steve, and I hope you enjoy listening. Here are Steve Dawson and yours truly on Caro Pop.
So this is The Tables Have Turned. Your listeners want to know, who is this Mark Caro person that they've been listening to?
They're dying to know this.
What made you want to be a journalist? Because you went to journalism school.
No, I never went to journalism school. I never took a journalism class after high school.
Wow.
The last journalism class I took was with Mr. Requi at Evanston Township High School. I was a cherub at Northwestern over the summer between my junior and senior years in high school. And then I was editor of the Evanstonian senior year in high school.
Okay.
And I spent a lot of my time in college at the University of Pennsylvania at the Daily Pennsylvanian, and I became editor of that. And I really, I mean, I had like one econ professor who was really like, how much are your parents paying for your education so you could spend all your time on an extracurricular activity? Like, he was very disdainful about it. Huh. But I did spend a lot of time working on the newspaper with people who have since, many of whom are very highly regarded and justly so journalists.
So I started that in high school.
Yeah. So I was like, so high school is when I started it. And
you went to school as an English major then.
Yeah, I was an English major by default because I thought I'd maybe become like a psych major. And like as is happening to my daughter right now, once I took some psych classes, I was like, I don't know if I want to be a psych major. And there was a London program over the summer. And since I was so involved in the newspaper during the year, I thought, oh, if I take this London program, I'll get two more English credits. And I've been taking English classes every semester. And boom, I'm an English major. So it really had kind of nothing to do with anything.
So you did go to London?
I did go to London for a summer, yeah. And so that was fun. But to go back to your original question, in high school, I was much more of a, and I'm not going to make this so much crap about high school, by the way. I wasn't popular. No, I was really like sort of a math and science nerd. Like my SATs were way better on math than English.
That's so surprising.
And I was like a mathlete.
Wow.
And I was, you know, I was doing, you know, chem phys, you know, AP chemistry and physics from like, you know, sophomore through senior years. And I took this journalism class.
You made a wrong turn.
Well, this is funny. I remember when I had college interviews, and I had one for a very good school, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, I'm really liking writing. And he goes, that's the wrong answer. You need to tell me you want to be an engineer, because all of your aptitude is in engineering and science and math.
A scientist or a chemist.
And I'm like,
researcher.
Yeah, I know. No. And my dad was a doctor and his dad was a doctor. I mean, they're both dermatologists. I didn't really, I mean, in the pre sort of computer era, like he had a movie screen set up in his study, which is at the top of the stairs. And he was, and he would show slides because he was a pathologist at Northwestern. And so pathology is diagnosing stuff.
Right.
And he would teach and he taught as well. So he was a derm path doctor. And so after dinner, we'd walk up the stairs and there would be these projections of the most disgusting skin diseases in the most disgusting areas to have skin diseases. And I just was like, I don't want to be a dermatologist.
Yeah.
That was not. And actually, my mom had a master's from Medill at Northwestern, and she really wasn't a practicing journalist, but I did kind of unconsciously follow in her footsteps instead of his footsteps. So I broke the three generation dermatology thing. But I said in that college interview, I'm like, I kind of think words are more interesting than numbers. And
it's so funny though, that you're fascinated with the arts.
Yeah, I am. And I was a total, I mean, like I was a total record geek and I would buy, you know, albums and like read along with the lyrics until I realized that when I was reading along with the lyrics, I was kind of made me anticipate sort of the shape of the song. And I didn't like that. So then I would listen without the lyrics and check the lyrics later. And, but it was very exciting to me to like get a new album. And I sort of went from, you know, being excited about, you know, the new Billy Joel record to in Supertramp or ELO. And then I sort of transitioned, made a sharp turn toward like Elvis Costello and Talking Heads and, you know, the B-52s and Vivo.
Exactly the same age. And you might be like
I might have
half a year older than me.
Yeah, I think I have a year. Yeah, so, I think I have 11 months on you.
So like, yeah, the big moments are probably about the same, but the big cultural moments are very similar.
Yeah, like, you know, like Squeeze was like, yeah, I'm going to listen to Squeeze and stuff. And then, you know, Supertramp will put out something new and I'd be like, ah, this is really, really slick. I mean, granted, the new Supertramp record at the time was like Famous Last Words, which is not a great record. And honestly, I've gone back to sort of the kind of stuff I turned my back on when I decided I was sort of too cool for it. And like Fear of Music by Talking Heads was so odd that it was just sort of weird to go back to this other stuff. But you know, those ELO records of the 70s, they hold up really well. And those Supertramp records, they have their problems, but they sound fantastic and the songwriting's really good.
Yeah.
You know, Roger Hodgson is a really good songwriter. I've been trying to get him on. I haven't had him on yet.
Yeah, he would totally fit your list.
I met him backstage at Ravinia too, and he played there years ago and he was very nice. So Roger, if you're listening,
he'll do it.
Come on. I you know, again, Breakfast in America. I love Crime of the Century. I want to get Ken Scott on because that record sounds so those two Supertramp records he produced, like, but Crime of the Century in particular.
Oh, I didn't know that he did this. Yes, you've gotten so close to Beatles in so many different ways.
Oh yeah, yeah. I had Pete Best.
Klaus Voormann.
Right.
If you got Ken Scott, that's another, like, you're one inch closer to.
Right. No, I had their photographer, Ethan Russell. But anyway, yeah. So when I was growing up and I was joining like the high school paper, I loved Siskel and Ebert. And it was just kind of interesting because I became sort of friends or at least friendly with them later. But I was really into movies. I remember like even on the high school paper, one of the first things I reviewed was like Time Bandits.
Oh,
yeah. I wrote a review of Time Bandits. And I think I said it was charming, which is not a word I would use as an adult. But, but you know, what do you know? Like, it's hard to sort of know the vocabulary for any of this stuff. And then when I was at the college paper too, I started off by writing some movie and album reviews. But then I'd always get sucked into the news side because I was a good reporter and I had sort of a sense of what reporting, I don't know, like asking questions. And I think to get on the thread that's going to end up with me doing this podcast and you talking to me about it, I think that the answer is going to be that I've always been a very curious bird and I like being able to ask people questions.
Right.
And the job that I had at the Chicago Tribune and before that at the Boston Phoenix, though that was never technically a job, which is why I left. Doing what I did, whether it was in high school, college, or professional, it gave me the license to ask people questions,
right?
Stuff that I was curious about. And, you know, I was always really curious about music and film, but a lot of other stuff too. And so being able to ask questions and being able to ask questions sort of in a sort of seeing someone at eye level and asking questions, you know, like interviewing Steven Spielberg about, you know, Minority Report or AI or Catch Me If You Can. I think I talked to him for all three of those movies. Wow. In person. Being able to ask people questions, I thought was great. And being able to hear their answers, was just fascinating to me.
And I think that's part of it too, is that you want to hear the answers. I think there's some podcasters who mostly want to hear themselves talk. I've had that experience. So they're asking you questions, but really they're sort of like filling in with their own sort of objective as they go and listening to a certain degree. But I think that you do have a natural curiosity and an interest in what people are saying and what inspires them to do what they do.
I do. And so it means that I have to prepare a lot for each interview. Yeah. Because I need to make sure that, I mean, like someone like you, I've known you for a long time and I've known and loved your music for a long time. And so I don't really have to work that hard. Like if we were going to do an interview now about ghosts and what's happening with your career right now, I mean, I would do some prep for sure, but it wouldn't be that hard. I mean, you and I have an entire book about songwriting,
right?
That is basically me prompting you with questions, right? And you answering, and then me responding to your answers and us going back and forth. So we have a pretty natural rapport. I mean, when I interviewed Colin Moulding of XTC and I made some reference to, you know, the single version of This Is Pop versus the album version of This Is Pop. And he's like, you've done your research. And I'm like, no, I didn't do any. I didn't. That's not research. That's just me having all that music kind of in my bones at this point, where I just like know that. I remember when I got this, you know, the Waxworks or whatever the XTC singles compilation was called, the version of This Is Pop was different than the one I had on the first album, White Music. So I'm like, oh, that one's produced by Mutt Lang. Cause of course I had to look it up, and why do they sound different? So yeah, it's I'm genuinely interested. And, and I also, one of the things that like I've talked to students sometimes about what I do and how to be a reporter and whatever. And I'm just like, the most important thing is listening.
Yeah.
Because you're going to pick up on stuff that you didn't anticipate. And if you're sort of just waiting to ask the next question, which I think I did early in my career, I think most people do early in their careers, right? They come up with their list of questions they're going to ask in an interview. And then they just kind of like run through them.
The worst I feel is when the writer has an angle and they're trying to box you into their angle.
So what angle were you getting boxed into?
I can't think of anything specific, but you can sort of tell when an interviewer has an agenda because the questions kind of all point in a direction. And it's just like, well, you came into this with a whole agenda. And
give me an example of an agenda.
Oh, gosh. Well, now you're asking me questions.
That's exactly it. I'm more comfortable doing that. But I'm also genuinely curious what agenda, like, oh, you know, you're Americana. When did you get into Americana?
Exactly.
Like that sort of thing?
Put into a style thing, or the thing like, oh, you've been married for a really long time to the person you collaborate with often, and that becomes the topic, which is interesting, but it's not the most interesting, I think. Anyways, do you like people in general?
I think I do.
I think you do too.
I think I do also. I'm sort of horrified by them, some of them.
Well,
a lot.
Sure.
Okay, I just texted you a photo and you're gonna probably react to it.
No way. Is this real?
Yeah, it's real.
When was that?
1984. You have to explain to you.
You're like best friends.
Yeah, it looks like it, right? You have to explain.
It's a baby-faced Mark Caro arm in arm with Sir Paul McCartney.
So this is one of the first interviews, celebrity interviews I ever did, which is crazy because I was a huge Beatle nut, as we've discussed. And when I was in college, they had a they had a junket for the movie Give My Regards to Broad Street, sure. which Paul McCartney had made and
right.
starred in and wrote songs for. No More Lonely Nights comes from that okay. movie. And it was a really bad movie. And it was coming on the heels of a kind of bad record, in my opinion.
What was the
Pipes of Peace. Like Tug of War was really good. And then Pipes of Peace was Pipes of Peace is the one with Say, 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 the Michael Jackson. Sure. Although Tug of War had Ebony and Ivory, which is the worst song on that too. But it just was kind of a rehash. It was just, there were some pretty not good songs on Pipes of Peace. But anyway, I got invited to this junket and I didn't know what a junket was. I've since gone on bunch of junkets. I was never like a junketeer in my career, but
so what's it to fill in?
So a junket is, you know, they gather all these journalists, to interview the people involved in a movie and they show them the movie and go to a screening of the movie.
Okay.
And they had a college press conference with Paul McCartney and there were 12 of us. It's just in a room with Sir Paul. It's, you know, it's all these like, you know, kids, you know, asking these questions of Paul McCartney. But it was like, remember someone asked, well, what was it like to act with Sir Ralph Richardson? And I was like, it's Paul McCartney up there. Why do you care about that? Like, who cares what it was? So I asked, and it's funny because I go in there and I'm like sort of smugly thinking, well, I know I'm a bigger Beatles Paul fan than any of these people, but I also was like an attitudinal college student. And I go, I said, seems like with this movie and with your last album, you're trying to present yourself as more of a role model. But do you think you undercut that by getting busted for drugs in airports?
Oh, no.
And he's like, well, you know, I mean, I'm sure your parents, you know, they come back home after a long day and they'll have a drink or something. And I just don't think this is any different from that. And, you know, I could have had one of my mates carry it, but that's just not me. It was actually a very reasonable response to a snotty little kid asking it. And I, you know, I didn't ask him any really, but I just sort of asked it like really sort of matter. Yeah, but it was like, it was very matter of fact. It was like, I got his attention, I guess, but he was very like, but he didn't take offense and he gave me a quite reasonable response. Yeah. I like nodded my head and then.
Well, because that had just happened though, right? Hadn't he just got, that was in sometime in the early 80s, wasn't it?
For some reason, I'm thinking that there was something kind of fresh at the time. I mean, the Wings thing blew up in like 79, the Japan thing.
Okay.
So there might have been some other more minor incident, but I don't know. Like, don't read in and don't at me that I'm wrong.
Getting
at the time,
busted for pot now just seems so.
No, I know. The whole thing seems so stupid. But it was kind of like this sort of like. I'm not going to defend it. It was obnoxious. The reason I told the story is because it's just an obnoxious question I asked Paul McCartney.
Because
I thought, well, this will be, you know, more relevant than, you know, what these other people are asking. And, you know, when you're younger, you try to make more of an impression. I mean, honestly, like as a journalist in general, you know, you just become less obnoxious as you get older because early on, especially when you're like being a rock critic,
I know.
You just sort of feel like you need to sort of put so much spin on the ball all the time. And
or
I don't know.
I maybe around then too, there was it seemed like rock criticism was more negative or more snotty.
Maybe. Yeah. It was sort of like you're kind of putting up, that's a whole other thing, but I know that when I got to ask a second question, I asked him about, you know, whether he'd heard like all these, because I had all these like bootlegs of Beatles things and, you know, like Leave My Kitten Alone and stuff like that on pretty good quality. So someone was leaking pretty good stuff. So I was basically asking if he'd heard that and whether it was ever going to come out. He's like, yeah, I've heard it. I was there, you know. he said he hoped it would come out. And it actually did, basically, on Anthology, you know, 12 years later. Anyway, but that was sort of interesting. I will try to tie this to this and to make it relevant to some extent, which was that I ended up interviewing a lot of musicians and movie people, actors, whatever, probably more movie people ultimately, in my career. And, you know, the first one I interviewed was Paul McCartney, who was like my biggest hero of them all. And, you know, he didn't invite, and he posed for that picture with me afterwards. Yeah. Maybe I'll have to put that on the site or something, but he posed for that picture with me. And,
He was totally nice, but he didn't invite me to visit him in Scotland. You know, like he didn't say, oh, you know, come visit Lyndon, me in Scotland sometime. You know, like my life didn't change. Like whatever those fantasies you have about meeting a celebrity are, it was like, okay, he did his job. And, you know, yeah. I did my job as like the kid promoting his movie.
Well, he's also been interviewed 10 billion times.
Exactly. And I bet only one person asked him that obnoxious question about the airport. So though maybe people, I don't know.
There's your in. You can write yeah. them and say, like, remember the kid that
yeah, I know.
That asked you the gotcha question?
I would still love to get Paul. I don't know if I just disqualified myself, but I remind, oh, no, that little, that that paper. Anyway, but anyway, at that point, I kind of wasn't really starstruck anymore because I sort of had this, I had this experience where I interviewed someone and it didn't really change my life. It just was like a conversation and right. it wasn't really a conversation because there were 12 of us in front of him. But after that, I just sort of wasn't quite as nervous, you yeah. know, and I was able to sort of talk to people. And in general, like when I was at the Tribune, because I did it for a while and because we used to have a lot more celebrities coming into Chicago, thanks to Oprah in right. large part. So they'd be here doing her show when a big movie opened. And also Siskel and Ebert, you know, Roger would talk to people for the Sun Times and he would do these big interviews and Gene occasionally, but Roger more. People would come in and they would do these features. And so I was at the Tribune where Gene was, but Gene's job really at the Tribune was to write these reviews and kind of shorter reviews at that point. And so I would always play that game of like, well, if you're giving the Sun Times, which was Roger Ebert, if you're giving him an hour, you got to give me an hour. Yeah. And if I can, I'd like to talk to them outside of the hotel room. So I would get all these people, like I, you know, go to Uno with Matt Damon, or you know, I took John Waters to Disney Quest.
Would these all be arranged through their like management?
No, it's like the publicist for the film. So the way that would work was that each studio in LA would work with usually a, I mean, there's a company now called Allied, and there were some other companies back then. There was like John Iltis and Sherman Wolf, Stuart Wolf worked like there too. And there were these local agencies okay. that okay. were contracted to like Paramount or okay. Warner Brothers or whoever. Like Universal had their own office on actually the fifth floor of the Tribune Tower. So like I loved the movie Babe and I could like go in there and they gave me like a cutout of Babe. You weren't really supposed to take gifts, but I think the cutout of Babe was okay. And I'd already raved about it anyway. So you work with the publicist and you'd say, oh, I'd like to, you know, they'd say, do you want to talk to Tom Cruise? And you'd say, oh, I'd love to talk to Tom Cruise. Can I get him out of the hotel room? And they'd say, no, he's Tom Cruise.
Is it because they're more open outside of the hotel room or they're
yeah because you're in a hotel room and then you're bringing in one reporter interviewer and then that okay. reporter then another one comes in so just, and then at some point they're like, did I tell this person this right. did I mention this to this person and they sort of start to lose track. But so if I can get them something. Yeah if I can get them somewhere else they're going to remember what they told me and okay. and also sometimes you'll get them interacting with stuff. You know, you'll just see them in,
sure.
I interviewed Julie Delpy, who was in like Before Sunrise sure. and Before Sunset. And she's so fantastic. And she directed a movie. And we met at this, we're sitting outside of this restaurant. I don't think it's not there anymore. It's renamed, but it was called Tempo in Chicago. Oh, yeah, at like that, Chicago right. and State.
Yeah.
It might not have been Chicago. I think it was around there or like Chestnut and State, something yeah, like that. And there was like this refrigeration truck that was parked there with, and it was on while we were, you know, waiting for breakfast and doing this interview or lunch or whatever it was. It might've been breakfast. And she just went over to this truck driver and started telling me, you turn that off. It's horrible for the environment and da, 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 da. And we ended up moving inside cause she was so irritated by it. But, that was just like, it's certainly in line with like her personality that I'd seen. So
and did that make it into your article?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
When I started, it was funny because there was no internet because I'm old. And when I would interview, say, John Travolta, you would call there's the morgue, which doesn't exist at the Tribune anymore. I mean, barely any of this stuff does, but there's a whole research library where they kept files of clips and also had access to all these databases because you didn't have access to the databases because there was no internet, at least not internet like general everyone having a computer where you can go online. And so I would say I'm interviewing John Travolta for this movie that he's in, Michael, that Nora Ephron directed. And I love the clips on John Travolta to sort of see what's out there. And sometimes, you'd get like, so they pull like the Who's Who entry on him. And then maybe Time Magazine had already interviewed him for this, or maybe so-and-so, or maybe, you know, other newspapers that are on the database. And so you'd pull these interviews and you'd be like, oh, that's kind of a funny story. I should get him to tell me that one, you know,
okay.
Or, oh, that's interesting that he talked about that, or, oh, nobody's asked him about this. But I kind of felt like when I started, because you have imposter syndrome when you start working for like the paper you grew up reading, sure, which for me was the Chicago Tribune, you're like, well, you know, I got to just sound like I'm writing a Tribune article. So it needs to sort of sound like all these other articles in a way. And so, because if you got like this funny story that he told the LA Times, well, no one in Chicago has read the LA Times. It wasn't that you didn't have the internet and you didn't have those distinguishing, you know, you didn't have it. Like there was nothing that would make anyone know that they've told that story before. And at some point, just a little, you know, flipped a switch and I'm like, I need to get these people to tell me the stories that they haven't told the LA Times, that they haven't told anyone else. I want it just to be what they're telling the Chicago Tribune, me. And I don't think it was just because you could sort of search and see what other people were doing. I think it was more, and I think actually my little light bulb moment was interviewing John Travolta the second time. Huh. So I interviewed him for this movie, Michael, and it was kind of like, the theme of that was sort of, it's good to be John Travolta, because he'd been like, his career was just in the toilet, and then he'd done Pulp Fiction and then Get Shorty, and all of a sudden he was like one of the biggest movie stars on the planet again.
Yeah, it was an amazing comeback.
Yeah, and that movie that he was in, Michael, was not a movie people, I mean, some of you out there will probably go, oh, that was a great movie. But really, yeah, you know, people do not look back on that movie like they do Get Shorty or Pulp Fiction for a reason. And then he was in this movie, A Civil Action, which was a good movie based on a fine nonfiction book. But he was coming back into town and I just interviewed him, and recently at least. So I didn't want to do this kind of career retrospective sort of thing on him because I'd already talked to him. And when I interviewed him, I just tried to come up with some other questions. And it's the sort of thing everyone does now. At the time, it's felt fresh to me, like sort of asking, well, you know, like what character actors have you really enjoyed working with? And, you know, just trying to sort of expand it beyond how much did you like making this movie? How did you prepare for it? And that sort of stuff, which again, I think it's like ask the stuff that you're interested in the answers to, and not the stuff that you think you need to ask, like, oh, how did it feel doing the sad scenes? You know, it's like, I don't care. It's like they're acting, you know, they probably felt like they were acting those sad scenes, you know?
And can you tell, I'm sure you can tell, if someone is actually engaging or if they're just
No, absolutely. And certainly on this podcast, I can also, you know, and usually it's felt like they are, and which is good. But there was a point where I was sort of asking him these questions, and John Travolta was like, it's like, oh, Mark, these questions, they're blowing my mind. You're really expanding my mind. Huh. Oh, bless you for asking these questions. Thank you. This is so like, this is stuff I haven't had to answer. And I really appreciate it. Would you like some orange juice? And he's like getting up, offering me orange juice. And then he's offering me other stuff. And it was so...
Where was this?
It was like in a hotel room. It really was. I didn't get to take John Travolta out to, you know, lunch or something. And, but it, at some point, so I was like talking to all these, you know, friends of mine afterwards. I'm just like, oh my God, this John Travolta interview, he's like offering me orange juice and saying, bless you for asking these questions and all this stuff. And everyone just thought it was funny. And then I sort of, my light bulb was, if this is the thing that I'm telling my friends, why isn't it what I would tell my readers? Like, why would I? And part of the reason is because I was always kind of allergic to putting myself in the story. Right. I don't like first person. I always think that like one of my rules is whoever I'm interviewing is more interesting than I am. which is why, partly why this is sort of weird for me, but I don't think of myself as like, it's not about me. You know, I'm not trying to take a selfie of me and my subject. I'm trying to take right. a really well-framed portrait of my subject, you know?
And well, that is exactly what I was sort of getting at earlier.
So with the Travolta thing, I ended up writing that up as a Q&A, which I really didn't. And I left in all of his little interjections and I wasn't making fun of him. It was just sort of showing that he was being sort of ingratiating, but that was clearly part of his personality. And like, you're trying to show people's personalities, and whether he's sure. putting on a show for me or whether he's really like that, you know, you never know. But I thought that was true of the moment.
Sure. Who was your editor then? Do you remember?
No, because it was a while ago.
I wonder how. Did you get any pushback?
No, not at all. It was fine.
Like that. Okay.
No, but I mean, I remember, like, for instance, like years earlier, I'd reviewed Procol Harum. I think it was like 93, 94, something like that. They're playing at the Vic, and they hadn't, you know, and Procol Harum hadn't existed for like, I don't know, since the late 70s. And Matthew Fisher hadn't been in the band since like 1969, when he was the organist on the first three albums, including, you know, I mean, Whiter Shade of Pale played the organ part. He ended up suing Gary Brooker for a share of the songwriting credit, and that became a very bitter thing. But this is before that had happened. But it was basically Gary Brooker, who was the lead keyboardist, singer, songwriter, you know, and then he would sing, you know, they weren't his lyrics, but Keith Reed wrote the lyrics, and they're very strange lyrics. But anyway, this version of Procol Harum had made a new album. Robin Trower was on the new album, but wasn't touring with them. But you had Matthew Fisher, and anyway, that's too much detail. But the point of it is, I went to review them, and I'm sitting there, and who should walk? It was a seated concert at the Vic, and who should walk right past me? And I looked at him, and I go, "Are you Joe Strummer?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "You know, I wouldn't have necessarily pegged you for coming to see Procol Harum in 1993 or whatever." He's like, "Oh, me and the mates, we love Procol Harum." And, you know, like, and it's interesting, because there are all these like kind of people from the punk rock scene who loved Procol Harum, even though, you know, I thought of Procol Harum as kind of coming out of sort of, you know, early sort of psychedelic turning into prog kind of thing.
Totally.
But like John Langford of the Mekons and Waco Brothers and 55 other bands in Chicago, you know, big Procol Harum fan. I mean, he's covered he's covered A Salty Dog. He and Sally Timms have done Hamburg. I mean, so there's this whole Procol Harum thing that I just didn't realize. And so anyway, I had this little chat with Joe Strummer, and afterwards Joe Strummer, you know, was leaving, and I said, "What'd you think?" And he's like, he gave me this big thumbs up. He's like, "What a voice." Because Gary Brooker sang the hell out of those songs.
Yeah.
But when I reviewed the show, I just wrote a review of the show, and I didn't mention seeing Joe Strummer. And later I was just like, that's so stupid. Like that's the best part of the story, is that, you know, like, it Joe Strummer. Yeah. But, you know, because I was sort of seeing myself through this narrow prism of, my job is to review the quality of what's on stage, and not to give a sense of, oh, this is this cool event that Joe Strummer of The Clash, but he was in town because Shane McGowan of The Pogues was in ill health. So he was fronting The Pogues the next night, I think at the Riviera.
Wow.
So Joe Strummer was in town, and I'd asked him about that too. So he was in town to be the lead singer of The Pogues. But the night off beforehand, he went to see Procol Harum at the Vic. So at some point it clicked, and I thought, go with the more interesting thing.
Right.
That's like, how do you distinguish yourself? It's not because it brings glory on me, but because it just makes you more interesting.
It's more interesting.
Read.
Yeah. But I could see that. It's like the job description or your experience. So it is a fine line, but in that case, it seems like that would have been more fun.
Right. But, and it would have been me. And again, the hurdle was me writing about me, right? Because it was an interaction I had.
Exactly.
And I didn't say, well, you know, and I was sitting in this seat, and this is how I experienced this Procol Harum concert. I just wrote about like the objective, you know, eye of like, you know, this, the drummer overplayed, he's no BJ Wilson, but, but it didn't matter because Gary Brooker sang, you know, a salty dog and brought the roof down, but I didn't say brought the ring, bring the roof down, because I knew that was a cliche.
You move back to Chicago because of the Tribune?
Well, when I was writing for the Phoenix, I mean, the Phoenix churned through a lot of young writers, and I was just
doing music stuff there.
I was doing, I kind of come in, I had like a column, a little bit like stuff I did for the Tribune later. It was called State of the Art, and it would be these kind of reported pieces about something happening with the opera company or whatever. I had this huge series I wrote early on about the Orson Welles Theater, which was repertory movie theater that kind of went through all these different phases and then ended up, I think it burned to the ground, and it was showing like supposedly showing some like porn stuff by the end, but it was really like Jonathan Demme sort of got a start there. I talked to him for that story. Like, I mean, like his movies, you know, were sort of championed by the Orson Welles cinema.
So you were doing like serious.
So I was doing serious stuff for the Phoenix, but they never hired me. It was like, there was a lot of, we have the milk and don't have to pay the cow. And so they basically would sort of get, you know, do it until you got fed up and left. And then other people would come in. Like,
okay.
I mean, I don't want to bring everything down, but like a friend of mine who was on the news side, and I started on the news side. Honestly, what happened was I started on the news side and I was doing all these newsy pieces, but I realized that most of the people on the art side, I liked hanging out with more, and they were critics who didn't really report that much. And so my niche was like, well, I can be the person who's really into music and movies and whatever else, but then I'll write the reported stories and I'll do the trend stories and stuff. And so that was, so I was like the newsy guy in the art section, which is what I did at the Tribune too. I was the newsy person in the art section for a long time. So that was what I did. But Danny Pearl, was on the news side, and he was there for a while, and we sort of would swap stories afterward about how, you know, I'm not trying to turn this into a dump on the Phoenix thing, but, you know, the Phoenix had some great writers who obviously were on staff and did fantastically, and some others.
Is there still a vestige of the Phoenix?
No, they're gone. They went under. They're one of the papers that they made a lot of their money on the back of the section ads.
Right.
Some of them, you know, more tasteful than others, but basically it's, you know, it's what devastated alternative media. And honestly, you know, regular print media was just, you know, Craigslist and, you know, all this online stuff just devastated, you know, where you're going to, you know, someone's looking for an apartment. They used to look in the back of the Phoenix or the Reader or the Village Voice.
Yeah.
And, that wasn't really happening so much.
Yeah, internet, man.
But anyway, yeah, no. So I wrote, when I was living in Boston, I wrote a few things for the Tribune. My cousin, Charlie Goffin, had been an intern at the Tribune and had introduced me to Richard Christensen, who was the entertainment editor as well as the theater critic.
Right.
And there was like a David Mamet, there was like a Vietnam veterans benefit that David Mamet, I think, oversaw in Cambridge. It might've been at the ART. I'm not sure. So I did a story. So Richard wanted a story from Boston on it, and I reported a story from Boston on it. Later, I did a piece about Larry Gelbart, who was one of the writers of MASH, and he had a show that was making fun of sort of a political satire, making fun of sort of the Bush One administration, and some of the Reagan stuff too, probably, but it's called Mastergate. I wrote about that. And so when, at some point when it was clear that I there was really not much reason to stay in Boston, you know, I like went and it, you know, I looked at like a small paper in New Hampshire that was basically offering me a job, or I could go back to my hometown paper and write for, you know, the paper I grew up for, but with no guarantee that I'd get hired. And so I did that.
Yeah.
And I didn't get hired for a long time.
Your dad was still here.
My parents were still here. My mom was still around. I was dating someone who lived here, so that helped.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, so I moved back here and I thought I'll just write myself onto the Tribune. And honestly, I wrote like 400 pieces and, you know, I wrote a series about ticket scalping, and I had this local music column where I met you, local heroes and Homefront. And the Homefront part was kind of the, you know, like your community bulletin board for local bands, and it would be like Smashing Pumpkins is going to release a single on Sub Pop, and Urge Overkill has their new record AmeriCruiser, or Supersonic Storybook's about to come out, and Stump the Host is going to do a single, you know. And yeah, that was how I got to know all of you. Material Issue is getting signed to Mercury.
Yeah.
So that was like my era. But I had a mailbox and all this stuff, and I was not on staff. But I was writing more than people on staff. And I don't know, I think later on it might have been sort of an issue, the number of hours I was working without benefits.
So they would pay you per piece?
Yeah, I would just get paid per piece, and it wasn't that much.
Yeah.
But I did finally get hired. And when I finally get hired, it was because they were starting this new section, Kid News. And so I was the writer for I was writing for 9 to 13-year-olds for 2 years, including like 6 months before we even launched it, sort of helping develop the section. But I, you know, as a guy in my, I guess, late 20s at that point, I was not really well-versed in what 9 to 13-year-olds were into.
Did they just say, we think you'd be good for this?
It was the only job there was. Like, okay. There are various hiring freezes over the many years I was at the Tribune. And one of the hiring freezes was, I mean, I'd been told I was hired like a year and a half earlier, and then they had a hiring freeze and got rid of the job before they did the paperwork to put me in the job. That's what I was told. So anyway, it was like, the one opening we have is to be on the writer for Kid News. So I'm like, okay. And actually, it was cool because I got to go to like all of the home playoff games for the Bulls 93 championship run. And I also interviewed Michael Jordan.
As the reporter for Kid News.
As a reporter for Kid News, yeah.
Awesome.
So yeah, my interview with Michael Jordan, which was just like after a not playoff game, like by his locker, I got credentialed for a game and asked him questions like, you know, when did you first stick your tongue out when you were playing? And, you know, when's the first time you dunked? And did that make you just want to dunk over and over? And like, it was kind of silly, but he must have liked it because Michael Jordan's restaurant, which was this huge restaurant that's not there anymore. Then it was also, it might've been Sammy Sosa's restaurant, and it was a bunch of different stuff. Anyway, that story was framed right by the elevator. So anyway, Kid News was frustrating because I wanted to write for people my age, you know, right. But Kid News was good as a writer because it made me strip out all of the cleverness, you know, it made me quit trying to impress people with my, you know, arcane references to Brady Bunch episodes or whatever I was doing that was sort of supposed to make me look smart. I thought, this won't mean anything. You know, there's just cut out the BS and just write it, you know?
Yeah.
And honestly, well, like my style in Kid News wasn't to write, you don't write down to people, you just write directly, and you just don't have, and maybe, you know, don't make your sentences 50 words long because you want to show how many clauses you can cram into it. So like as an exercise, it was kind of good for, as a writer, for me to have done Kid News, even though you know, it got on my nerves that I had to do it for 2 years. Like, I felt like the work I'd done up to getting hired had, you know, meant that I should have just been working for the Tempo feature section and doing the kind of stuff I was doing. And I didn't. But like a lot of the things that I did that I didn't want to do, I was sort of glad to have done them.
Well, it shows to your character that you embraced it and went with it and still think of it as like, well, there was a positive side.
There you go. Yes. Well, I didn't have a chance. It got me on staff. And even then I had to jump through so many hoops for that to work. I mean, I'm not going to get into like all the.
Yeah. We don't need to get into the politics of the Tribune.
No. But and just like what happened to happen. And it just was crazy. But, and then like right after I was finally on staff, I got picked up by the Metro staff. Like, Features owed Metro a body. And because a Metro reporter had become the fashion writer, the fashion critic. So Metro was like, well, we'll take that guy.
So did Kid News go away, or did
Kid News stayed, but they had other people working on it, and it did eventually go away. And it was a good idea too. I think it didn't generate the advertising, and it didn't ultimately have sort of the internal support. I was sad to see it go. I know, you know, there were people who would come to me later, including some people I worked with, be like, "Oh, I can't believe I'm working with you. I used to read you in Kid News." I'm like, I feel so old now, because I was like a young person when I started at the Tribune, and then I was like old person all of a sudden. But yeah, so then I was in Metro in the Southwest Bureau in Orland Park, and I was commuting 70 miles a day from Lakeview to Orland Park. And I had this 1983 Toyota Tercel that like already had like, I don't know, 80 something thousand miles on it. And it just, I got it up to, I put like 15,000 miles on it in like 8 months. Oh, and then it just died and I had to get a new car. But, which the Tribune wasn't going to buy me or anything. It was just like, no, you're commuting 70 miles a day now. And, you know, I grew up in Evanston and I lived on, I knew the North Side pretty well, but I did not know the Southwest suburbs. So again, I hated the commute. I wasn't that crazy about, having to confine myself to that, suburban stories when I just wanted to write about, movies and whatever. But on the other hand, I did it for like a year and a half and I learned a lot about that area of the city.
I couldn't
even, and I didn't know it, Yeah. So Tinley Park was one of my towns and, that's where the World Music Theater is, that has gone through about 55 name changes since then. Orland Park, the Paloses. I covered this very high profile murder trial, which was, that was like a real experience. It was a 17-year-old who had killed a 13-year-old girl. Mm. And there were a lot of really gnarly, gnarly details that I'm not going to get into in this. But anyway, so yeah, that was another experience I was glad to have had. But I was also really glad when I finally...
you ever expected.
No. I was like, wait a minute. Why do I have to keep paying my dues? These other people don't have to pay their dues.
You kind of embrace whatever it is that's coming at you.
As a writer, you want to learn stuff. The whole thing about being a writer and a journalist to me is that you're never doing the same thing day after day. You're always talking to different people and learning different things. And so I'm spending time with like the mayor of Orland Park. And it's like, it's not really what I'm as interested in, but like now I know how a town like Orland Park operates and how Orland Hills, which had this very contentious city council or town council or whatever. I mean, it was just like, they would just be fighting and I'd be like, oh, so there's all this dysfunction on this local level that I'm learning about.
No, I mean, people are interesting. Stories are interesting. I remember Peter Margasek, I was asking him once, he really wanted to get a job at the Reader as a music writer.
Right.
But they kept stringing him along as well. And he was just doing little reviews and then they offered him a job as a food critic, which is interesting.
Huh.
And I...
So was he doing that when Bill Wyman was still the music critic?
I think so.
Okay.
And I said, well, is that upsetting to you? He's like, no, I just want to write. I just want to write about things. I don't care what it is. And I think it sounds like it's similar. I mean, you would prefer to be writing about something that you are passionately interested in, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, I finally got to come back to the Tempo section, which was the daily feature section, which is no more. It's just arts and entertainment, and it's not even a standalone section every day anymore. But I'm not there, so, it's like I'm not going to be, like, playing the violin on the way things used to be. But it was a pretty robust section where it was, a lot of daily arts and entertainment stuff was in there. But you also could, come up with a story like... What difference does it make if you get a toothbrush with the bristles raised up in the middle or the bristles raised up around the side? And does it matter if they're soft in the middle and hard on the outside or hard in the middle? Like there are 1,000 different toothbrush varieties. I'm going to ask some dentists whether it makes any difference at all. That story led to one of my favorite celebrity interview stories. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Okay. So it's kind of just a coincidence that this story was on the front of the Tempo section the day that I was interviewing Cuba Gooding Jr. And he was in a movie. I think the movie was Instinct. It was he and Anthony Hopkins co-starred. And it was a pretty serious drama. And it was his first really high profile job after he'd gotten the Oscar for supporting actor for Jerry Maguire, Cameron Crowe's wonderful movie, in which he also had this amazing, performance at the Oscars when he won.
Right.
Where he was just so ebullient and infectious and fun. And anyway, whatever's gone on with Cuba Gooding Jr. since, he was just like totally, it was just great. And I interviewed him at the Four Seasons. He was staying at the Four Seasons, and it just, I'm just telling you, it happened to be the day that this toothbrush story had run. Okay. So that's just like the little thing to file away that I'd written this toothbrush story, and it was on the front of the Tempo section. And I went to interview Cuba Gooding Jr. at the Four Seasons, and we talked, and it was a pretty serious interview. And we talked a lot about kind of racial politics in Hollywood and how things were still tough. And, you know, he was like, he was not kind of dressing stuff up, but he also wasn't, you know, making a grievance. He was very credible in what he was talking about, and he was very thoughtful, and it was a really good interview. And then at the end of it, I was like, well, what are you doing now? And he's like, I got to go sing the seventh inning stretch at Wrigley Field. And I'm like, can I come? So the publicist, so he's like, sure. And the publicist is like, yeah, well, why not? So I rode along with Cuba Gooding Jr. in this limo to Wrigley Field. He's escorted into the game. You know, the game's like in the middle of the game. We're probably like in like the fifth inning or something like that. Escorted into a empty skybox. And we're just sitting there. And there's like this, there's sort of this walkway when you're going to the skyboxes in Wrigley, where the people who are sitting sort of in the back of the terrace reserved seats, you know, the what you used to call the lower grandstand, now a terrace reserved. You know, you could see people walking on this walkway. And you know, so we walk on the walkway, nobody's noticing us. We go into a skybox, and then when it's getting close to, you know, time for him to do the seventh inning stretch and sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, you know, someone comes and gets us and escorts us up. I think he probably talked to, you know, whoever was in the booth at that point, you know, about what he was working on or whatever. But it wasn't like sort of this long interview. And it was time for him to sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And, you know, he takes the microphone, stands up on the broadcaster's table, and there's like this open window, because the window's open, and he leans his body all the way out the window. He's just barely holding on. The publicist looks like she's going to have a heart attack. He's like, and he's like, and he's just doing his sort of like, I just won the Oscar kind of thing. And he's just like singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And, you know, at the end of it, he's like, show me some runs, and everyone's going nuts. And again, the broadcasters and everyone are just like, oh my God, he's going to fall out of the booth, and he's going to, you know, this is like this is it for, you know, the seventh inning stretch in Cuba Gooding Jr. And, but he pulls himself back in, and the crowd goes nuts, and they're just like cheering him on. And we go back along that same walkway to the skybox we were in to watch a little more of the game, and everyone's just yelling at him, show me the money, show me the money, woo! And like, just like night and day, everyone sees him and they're just all cheering him, and he's like pumping his fist. And then we get back into the skybox, and he turns to me and goes, I am living Ferris Bueller's day off. Which I thought was hilarious. And then at some point we left, probably a little before the game ended, take the limo back to the Four Seasons. And I'm going to just walk up from the Four Seasons back to Tribune Tower. He's going to go back into the, and like, well, thank you for letting me do that. That was really fun. It's like, no, I appreciate it. And he goes, but I got one more question for you. I'm like, what? And he goes, what kind of toothbrush do you use? And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. So Cuba Gooding Jr. read that day's paper, which most people don't do, read that section, recognized that story, and recognized that the guy who was one of the several people he was talking to that day had written that story, and then kept that in his back pocket for like several hours, like from when I talked to him to after we went to the thing, just so he could spring that on me the moment I was leaving. I was like, oh my God, he's good. So that was that.
So did you get insight into what the best toothbrush is?
You know, it seemed like it really didn't make much difference. Most of them didn't think of that. You know, it's like soft is better than hard.
Oh, really?
Soft is better than hard on your gums. Yeah, get a soft one, or get an extra soft one. You know, the extra soft ones kind of wear down. The takeaway is get a soft toothbrush because it's better on your gums. But now it's like you get the sort of motorized ones, right? Which I wasn't doing at the time. Right. So, you know, and then do you want the Oral-B round one, or do you want the Philips Sonicare kind of more rectangular one? That's like another Tempo story, but there's no Tempo section and I'm not there anymore. So someone else is going to have to do that.
So at some point you moved into,
I don't know whether we're going to lose all of that, but anyway, there's a funny story.
At some point you move into this situation where you're traveling the world with the symphony.
Yeah, that was good.
That was incredible.
That was fun. Yeah, that was like one of my rebounds. That was another That was another thing.
It's sort of like all that stuff you did, all that time you put in paid off to get this awesome situation.
I mean, you know, not to make this all about the Tribune, because we could talk, but my Tribune career was very, it's odd, but it was fine. I just, you know, I got to do a lot of really great stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I've been, not having been there for several years, I sort of look at the culture and I just see so many things that were just very strange and not supportive about it. And at some point when things were going south in various ways and stuff that I wanted to happen didn't happen, I thought, you know what? I'm not doing this for, you know, like the editors or the bosses or the people who decide who get promotions. I'm doing it for the people who read what I do, mm-hmm. and the people who I'm covering.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like there's journalists in general have this bad habit, and I certainly had it early on. And I tried to cure myself of this pretty early in my career of like looking at what other people are doing and measuring yourself against that. And it's like, why is that person getting asked to do this? And why is that person getting asked to do this? And why don't I get that story? And why don't I get this? And blah, 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 me, me, me. And it's like, you know, there's so many stories out there and we're in Chicago.
It's not helpful.
You know, and it's just like, so it's just like, just come up with something else, you know, like if you, for some reason, I just flashed on this Prince lyric, which I think is on, I think it might be on the 12-inch version of I Give You Heaven. And anyway, but he goes, take this beat. I don't mind. I got plenty others and they're so fine. And I thought, but I think you almost have to sort of have that attitude as a journalist. Like, okay, fine. You know, you got this job that I wanted. I'm going to come up with something else, you know? So it's like, I reviewed movies for like a long time, like 9 years without being officially the movie critic. Fine, I'm going to write a story about foie gras that's going to go on the front of the Tribune and turn into a book. How you know?
Was that your idea?
I had this. Okay, that's like another thing. I'm going to try to avoid the Tribune politics of it. I was no longer right. I was the movie writer for a long time, and then I was writing other stuff too. And in this period early on of me writing other stuff, I was doing a magazine article on a very high profile restaurant that was going to open, and I was writing the cover story and it got killed inexplicably, and I still never understood why it got killed, and if I told you what it was, you'd find it inexplicable too. But anyway, it was a restaurant related story, and Phil Vitel, the Tribune's restaurant critic and a tremendous writer and even better person, said, well, here's another story you could do. Charlie Trotter's quit serving foie gras. Maybe there's a story here. and it was kind of interesting because Trotter was someone who actually, when you talk to the people who supply foie gras, was like one of the top five restaurants in the country of using it at Charlie Trotter's. But he decided that he was no longer okay with the humane. I mean, Steve, I can go down a very long foie gras rabbit holes.
So if people don't know.
What happened was I did a story for the Tribune about, because I was curious about like whether this is actually ethical or unethical to eat the fattened liver of a force-fed duck or goose. That's what foie gras is. And I learned a lot in reporting this first story. And I called, you know, I called all these other chefs around town, like Jean Joho at Everest. Like, did you quit serving foie gras? No, I'm not going to quit serving foie gras. And I, you know, it was all these different ones. And I talked to Rick Tremonto, who was at True at the time. And this was a period pre-Alinea, where Trotter and True were considered the two, like, you know, best restaurants in Chicago. A little for Le Francais. I'm not sure if it was still.
So is this the 90s? Is that what we're talking?
This is 2005.
Okay.
And honestly, Alinea opened in 2005. But this was like right around then. Like, I think this was like the period, I think this was like before Alinea had opened, but he'd already closed Trio. Cause I'd done a big story about Trios last night and I got to know Grant Achatz, and that was a fun other thing. But the foie gras thing was that I talked to Rick Tremonto at True, and I didn't realize that Rick had worked for Trotter beforehand, But he was just like, look, you know, it's just a little hypocritical because, you know, either you're, you know, you could talk about veal and, you know, right. whatever farm you're getting it from, you're still killing those babies, and he still serves veal and he still serves this other part stuff. So, you know, yeah. like it's a little hypocritical of him to like make a issue about foie gras. So of course, then I called Charlie back and I told him what Rick Tremonto has said. And I was recording. I usually don't record my interviews, but Charlie talks so fast that I was recording this. And he's like, well, you know, Rick Tremonto is not the smartest guy on the block. I mean, just because you kill animals, you know, to eat them, doesn't mean they should have to suffer. Right. It's just he can't be that dumb, is he? You know, maybe we should serve up Rick's liver for a little treat. It's certainly fat enough. And I was just like, you just have like one of the top chefs in Chicago basically threatening to eat the liver of the other top chef in mm-hmm. Chicago. And so I think you might have put a story about duck livers on the front page of the Tribune, and it did go on the front page of the Tribune above the fold. But the story was much longer, and it did get into, I mean, I talked to like the animal rights people, and I talked yeah. to the people who ran two of the three farms in the U.S. because there are only three farms doing foie gras. And I really tried to get into the ethical thing. And then Joe Moore, who is the alderman for the far north side, Rogers Park, basically, proposed that the city ban foie gras, and they just kind of went along with it
based
without
on
looking
that article.
So here was the thing. I had like when I got the book contract to write The Foie Gras Wars, you know, everyone's favorite book of 2009. I was asking Joe Moore about this because I knew he'd proposed this. I'm like, where did you get the idea to propose this? Were you approached by Farm Sanctuary? Because they were very involved in it, animal rights group.
Okay.
He's like, no, I'd read the story in the Tribune. And he's describing the story. And I was like going, oh my God. It was me.
It's your fault.
It's my fault. You read my story. I'm like, I didn't say to ban foie gras. Charlie Trotter didn't say to ban foie gras. He's a libertarian. He was against anything. He just thought everyone should follow their own conscience, you know, and Rogers Park didn't have any restaurants serving foie gras. It's like, you know, he's like, and later, this is like one of the most Chicago things. This is like, again, far afield on what we're talking about. But I talked to Ed Burke, you know, who really was sort of, you know, running city council yeah. back then. And I was interviewing for the book, and I said, why did you guys go along with this? You know, because then Daly just immediately started making fun of it, and everyone, and they finally repealed it 2 years later, which was fantastic because they repealed it the month my book was due. So it gave me like an ending. I mean, I didn't know what the ending was going to be. So, I mean, there's a lot more than just Chicago in the book. There's like, I go to France, and there's stuff about Philadelphia and California. But anyway, I said to Ed Burke, why did you go along with this? And he's like, well, you know, Joe Moore, he doesn't get a lot. He doesn't get a lot to go his way. Sometimes you got to throw him a daisy. It's just like, this is how Chicago politics works.
Yeah, let's throw him a bone.
Throw him a daisy.
Oh my God.
Throw him a daisy. Hilarious. So anyway, so that's how I did the foie gras wars. But
crazy.
But I got a book out of it. That was fun. I got to write a book.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really well received. It did not become, I was hoping it would become like the Omnivore's Dilemma with a Sense of Humor and like become known as well as that. And it didn't. But, you know, most people who do any sort of album, movie, book, whatever, you always have your dream of what you want it to happen. Oh, and then you have the reality of the world, and then you just move on, you know, right. And it's just like, the book exists. It didn't exist before. Yay. It has a really great cover too.
They all have an arc where you like, it's all the work you put into it. It's an incline. It comes out, there's a reception, you get reviews. And then eventually it just, the arc always goes down and you're like, oh, okay, well that happened.
I mean, and I will say that, to some extent, and I don't know whether this is really true or not, but I feel like that arc at least has worked to my advantage somewhat with Carol Pop, because I have gotten several authors a good 6 months after the whole publicity thing is done.
Okay.
And so it's like, oh,
right.
You know, someone's interested in this book after nobody's been interested in the book for several months.
Right.
We'll say yes.
So and you then, understand how that works. And
yeah. So, and look, I mean, it's interesting because it's like, I've pitched a lot of publicists on interviews, and it's frustrating because they're like, well, you know, there's your podcast, or I could try to get major dailies. And I'm like, there aren't that many major dailies, but go ahead. But in their mind, there's sort of a hierarchy. I feel like the best stuff I've done is where I'm talking to people who aren't getting bombarded with requests and aren't sort of giving multiple interviews in which they're saying the same stuff. It's like, yeah. Oh, you're interested in what I'm doing. Thank you. You know, not that they need to thank me, but I think that most artists just like talking about their art,
yeah.
Like talking about their work. And I like talking about their work, and I don't like talking about, like, you know, their sales figures so much, you know, and sometimes
yeah.
It'll be sort of a logical thing to ask about, you know, in terms of, you know, how did you like being on a major label? And, you know, was it hard when, you know, you got dropped from the major label, you know, like stuff like that. But in general, you know, it's, I don't know, you just sort of realize, and especially as you get older, that like everything, like having anything come out and be popular or successful or just beloved or liked, it's like a little miracle, you know?
Yeah.
And, truly. You know, if I, you know, like some of the movie reviews I wrote, I mean, I really tried to sort of, as I went along, if I was going to be mean, I would try to be mean to something that could take it, you know, like, you know, Adam Sandler's 8 Crazy Nights, you know, Adam Sandler was not going to like lose sleep over me thinking that, you know, that was a step backward for him,
right.
You know? There were some people who did take offense at reviews I wrote, and, you know, later, yeah. But, and sometimes I felt bad about it. Sometimes I was like, well, that's just sort of the nature of the job. But, you know, it's better for someone to, you know, pay attention and not like it than to not pay attention. You know, the most brutal thing is when you put out something and there's no one to review it and nobody cares.
That's
and
the Neil Young thing. He doesn't care if it's a good or a bad review. He just wants people to respond.
Yeah. It's, you know, art is a dialogue, right? I mean, a lot of people don't feel that way. They're just like, I do my work and it goes out into the world and then I don't look at it and I don't look at the reviews and I just go on to my next thing.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm more socially oriented than that. You know, it frustrates me that I didn't solve the foie gras dilemma. Like that people are having the same arguments, making the same points, without sort of the knowledge that I brought into the world in that book.
Well, there's,
cause it's, a, and the book is nuanced, which is also a problem because it doesn't say one side's right.
Right. So you're not trying to make a case. You're providing information.
Yeah, no. And I mean, the thing that I found was just that I found the farms to be pretty sympathetic because there were only like 3 of them and they were totally transparent. Unlike, you know, I was in the same doing the research for this. I'm just like asking Butterball if I could see how they prepare Thanksgiving turkeys. And they're like, no. And I'm asking, you know, Tyson or Purdue, like, can I see how chickens are produced? And they're like, no. And the foie gras people are like, this is how it works. And you see it. And it doesn't look like torture. And then there's all this, you know, discussion about it. But at the end of the day, what it looks like or not, you still may think that force feeding an animal is not something we should be doing, no matter how good it tastes. And no matter how much an animal's biology is, you know, conducive to that, because like a duck, see, this is, I just go down these, like, the problem with foie gras, you know, this is like cramming up my head too. Like ducks and geese, waterfowl store fat under their skin and in their liver. So if they overeat, their liver gets fatty. You know, I mean, when you're going to have a hamburger or something, I mean, there's all sorts of manipulation to all these animals. But that doesn't mean it's all okay, you know, and the foie gras producers also would say it's, you know, he'd say, you know, just because, you know, someone hits his, you know, spouse doesn't mean that it's okay for me to, you know, like, you know, someone murders a spouse means it's okay for me to hit my spouse or something like that. Like, it's not moral relativism. Like, they're aware of those arguments and they're just like, it's really fine. You know, the ducks aren't feeling it or whatever. But I just sort of tried to describe it all. And then you could just sort of read the book and decide whether you think it's fair or not. I found that the animal rights people in general, I tend to be sympathetic with animal rights and try to be an ethical eater, omnivore. But I also thought that, like, it's such low-hanging fruit to make. It's so easy to make foie gras sound disgusting and torturous that it's like, I don't know.
Well, you're right about the veal thing, too. I mean, that's problematic.
But no, but just, like, in general, like, you would talk to these people I'm sorry, I just get back on this. I would like the people who are like protesting the hardest against foie gras and like really like going on, like there's like a little restaurant in Philadelphia that just had like a foie gras peppercorn sauce on a hanger steak. And these guys would like put the flat screen TVs over themselves and walk among the outside diners showing these tortured ducks and saying, you know, the owners of this restaurant are guilty of duck murder and duck rapists. Like, I don't know how that works. But it was like really like over the top, their tactics on just this ingredient. And I'd say, well, is foie gras the worst? And they'd be like, no, chicken's the worst. Like your average chicken, they're like, your average chicken is treated worse than any of your foie gras ducks. Yeah. But, you know, we can't go after big poultry. We can go after the three farms in the U.S. that make foie gras. And then it was went down to two because California banned it. And so they banned one of them out of existence. So yeah, it's just, it's, you know, there's a, you try to sort of get these sort of moral clarity on like how you decide what's okay to eat. And there are all these other factors in it. And so that's what I found interesting. Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. And now you can get DDH Colada Hero, a hazy double IPA laden with a classic swizzle of coconut and pineapple notes. DDH Colada Hero is lush and tropical, offering waves of sweet piña colada bliss. Crack a can and let the rush of island vibrancy whisk you away.
Since you started doing the podcast, which started in September of 2021, which means it's coming on 3 years, which is crazy.
Yeah, I think
so many interesting people. Probably a lot of them are people like you've always wanted to talk to. A lot
started
of
with Richard Thompson,
which is, I mean, come on.
I mean, the first four I did before I'd posted one episode. And so I was just like, that was like really awesome. Cause all these people agreed to do it when there was no kind of proof of concept. It was like Richard Thompson, Bruce Thomas of the Attractions with Elvis Costello. Was Ricardo Muti in there? The first five were,
well, you had a relationship with Muti though.
Yeah. Muti, I had a relationship with, I had Lonnie Jordan from War because they were putting, Rhino was putting out this War box. Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's.
Oh, wow.
I think she might have been the third one. She was totally gracious in doing that. I just had sent her a note on Twitter because we followed each other.
Hmm. So how did you get into interviewing like these audio people? Like the mastering people and recording engineers.
Yeah, I kind of was going down my own sort of vinyl audiophile, not audiophile, but certainly vinyl nerd hole. And I was like just reading about these different pressings. And I was really curious about, because like these new pressings of these albums would come out and there would be so many different pressings. I mean, like Joni Mitchell, there are just so many, like Kevin Gray did a version of Blue, but then Bernie Grundman did a version of Blue. And I'm like, well, which one's better? And I've joined this Vinyl Me Please record club. And, you know, Ryan K. Smith will do, you know, some of the same records that Bernie Grundman's doing. And I'm like, well, which is better, these or if you got like a really good original copy?
See, this feels like the science part of you.
Like yeah, maybe
SAT strengths showing up.
There you go. Like, I always thought the science math thing sort of carried over in what I did because I felt like when I wrote, this is a little bit of a side note, but I felt like when I was writing, I really wanted everything to fit together in a way that seemed almost mathematical. And I don't, I mean, I try to like have things flow and I sound like a writer too, but I'm also a tight writer. Like like I got driven crazy if, you know, you say something in 10 words that you could say in four. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like finding the right word to me is important. And yeah, just this idea that somehow something, you know, what is like, I didn't really know what mastering was. And I've used the term and I've had stuff mastered and, you know, I'm sort of sneakily, stealthily on a Clash tribute record. And so I've heard the thing I recorded get mastered and, you know, I know what a difference it makes.
So you sought these people out on your own then?
I did. Yeah.
So there wasn't like...
Yeah. So Bernie Grundman was the first one and I just looked him up and I called his office and I got his, probably emailed his assistant, and I just sort of pitched what I was doing, and they said
it seemed like he was way into
okay.
it.
Yeah, he was great. And then I had Kevin Gray, who I've had on three times now. He's really interesting, and I've like gotten together with him in California and when he was in Chicago. Like, he's a great guy, mm-hmm. but his stuff is so good. Like, it just sounds so, I mean, good is like not a scientific word, but and it's like, well, is it because of the equipment he's using? And it was interesting because when I was in LA, I visited both of them because I wanted to see their setup. So like last year, like in May, I think it was, I went to Bernie Grundman's studio, and he's in Hollywood, and it's this big, you know, facility with like all these gold records on the wall and these different mixing rooms and you know, and reception area. And Kevin Gray is deep in the valley in his own house. And this sort of what would be sort of the coach house or garage has been retrofitted to become the mastering studio. Mm-hmm. And he's turned his living room into a recording studio to kind of ape, you know, what Rudy Van Gelder was doing in all these jazz recordings he did, you know, many for Blue Note, but also for Prestige and stuff. And so it's just fascinating. But he's like built all his own equipment and has all this tube stuff. And so, but and just like, it's just sort of like a totally different, and they both do great work, but it's totally different sort of presentation and just the kind of homegrown nature of, you know, what Kevin's doing. I mean, he doesn't have, you know, records anywhere.
Do you have a preference between the two of them?
It's all just sort of like, it's rare that you would have both of them do the same project.
Okay.
So I've heard wonderful mastering things that each of them have done. You know, I've probably bought more things because Kevin Gray did them in the last couple of years than Bernie, but Bernie's a legend and he's been around. I mean, they've both been around for a while. Bernie's been around a little longer. You know, I've got some great Bernie Grundman mastered things and some great Kevin Gray stuff too. And Chris Bellman is in Bernie Grundman's studio and he's done some fantastic stuff too. It's all cool.
And do you think you listen differently now after spending all this time?
I do. And I don't know how, I mean, part of what happened was, and this kind of gets some of the genesis of the podcast too, but certainly of my listening. I had the same turntable from when I was in high school. I never disconnected it. I always had records, but I generally listened to CDs and didn't really pull out the records as often. But at some point I sort of went back to pulling out the records. I'm like, oh, I really like pulling out a record and flipping it over and hearing the needle go on the vinyl. And, you know, I like the warm sound of it. And there is a difference between that and a lot of the digital stuff. And so and then record store day, I always found was fun. So I would sort of buy more records. And then at some point I thought, I've had this turntable for so long. We're in the middle of the pandemic. I'm not spending any money on live shows. So I'm going to buy myself a new turntable. I got a really nice turntable. And then I also upgraded my amp at the time because my amp was underpowering my speakers. And then it was like, whoa, I'm just hearing all this other stuff that I hadn't heard. Yeah. And so I was just sort of picking up all these. And then, you know, because vinyl was selling more, there's just more vinyl being made and more money being spent on getting Kevin Gray and Bernie Grundman and Chris Bellman and Ryan Smith to master them. And so you would hear that. And sometimes then I would find like the original of something in a used record store. And then I would be like, oh, and I'm going to compare it like the vinyl Me Please Isley Brothers Go For Your Guns versus the original Go For Your Guns. And the vinyl Me Please one sounded better.
On big records, a lot of times they use really cheap vinyl, you know?
Right. Well, but the other thing is then it's all about how it's sourced. So that's kind of how I went down the Bernie Grundman rabbit hole, because you would get stuff that would sound okay, but it's like you're sort of using like a digital master and just pressing it on vinyl. But the really good ones were the ones where they would go back and find the original master recording and master it from that using updated equipment that pulls more sound off of the original master recording than the masters did back in 1972 or whatever.
Right.
On the other hand, some master recordings have degraded over 50 years, so there's not as much information to pull off of them as the other right. ones. So that's where it gets into sort of like, well, which is better? And it's like, well, it kind of depends, because it depends on so many.
How well it was stored.
Stored well, if it's in good shape, if you're using, and then, you know, sometimes they'll make like a one-to-one analog copy of the analog to keep it all in the analog world. But then sometimes there will be a very, very high definition digital copy used somewhere in the process, which Mobile Fidelity got sued right. about. But you know, a lot of those sound fantastic. So for me, it was like, I would like to compare them. So that's the science part of it, I guess, is just sort of comparing them. And there's also just, there's a community out there that's very interested in this stuff. Yeah. And I was going on these like Reddit or Steve Hoffman music forums or wherever else, in Facebook groups, and seeing like all this discussion about like, oh, did you get the Bernie of this and the Kevin of that? So I'm like, well, I got to talk to this Bernie, because everyone's talking about the Bernie, you know? So that's how I got on those. And then those episodes did really, really well. I mean, the Bernie Grundman one, I think, is the third most downloaded of any of them. And it was like basically Bernie Grundman, Kevin Gray, and Ryan Smith were 3, 4, and 5. Wow. And Steve Albini was 1. So that's another one. And the Steve Albini one was the one where I was in his studio and he was talking about how he cuts everything and all his analog stuff. And Dave Gregory from XTC was 2. And he was the only one. Bruce Thomas has moved into the 5 spot. And so Ryan's now 6. Oh, the 3 of the 6, top 6, are still mastering engineers. And they, because part of it is because you'd post it on one of these forums, and then everyone would be like, oh my God.
When you hit a niche target, all those people are going to be interested.
Yeah. So that's sort of like, I've had some movie people, and some have done all right, and some of them are bigger names, but sometimes the biggest names don't get the most downloads.
That's
it. It's sort of, it's more the ones who people are most passionate about. And maybe those people who they're most passionate about haven't been heard from as often. And so that's what's kind of cool about it.
Like, I listened to the Paul Williams one. I love
the Paul Williams one.
So great.
Yeah.
And the Peter Frampton one was really cool.
The idea that I was able to talk to Peter Frampton, and it's funny, like I was, there's a sad generational thing where I tell younger people, like, I got Peter Frampton. They'd be like, who? You know, people my age were like, oh my God, you know, he was the biggest person on the planet for a while.
Well, and I didn't know all that. I didn't know that he was on All Things Must Pass.
I didn't know he was on All Things Must Pass either.
So it's really interesting. I mean,
and basically the whole talk box thing came out of him being on All Things Must Pass. That's what was fascinating to me, because Pete Drake was playing pedal steel and he just had the talk box and the thing and he's just going, wah, 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 you know, like that. And that's where he got it from. It was because he was an uncredited session player on All Things Must Pass. And that's the sort of thing where I thought, oh my goodness, it's like the unwritten history of music and like connecting the things that you didn't know were connected, which was George Harrison doesn't make All Things Must Pass. And, you know, Do You Feel Like I Do? Maybe doesn't have that whole wah, 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 wah in the middle of it, you know?
That's right. Because Pete Drake, like in the 60s, did like pedal steel with that. It was
And then, you know, and then
novelty,
Rocky,
right?
Yeah, and Joe Walsh had it on Rocky Mountain Way and whatever else. Yeah. But
like, even with the Steve Van Zandt one, you got him to open up in a way that it seems like he probably doesn't. Maybe he does that with other people, but it felt like he was just very human.
Yeah, that one felt like that to me too. I'd love to have him on again, because I really didn't even ask him about like any of the Springsteen stuff, because it was really more about him. His book is called Unrequited Infatuations. And there's this tone of it in the book of him being like, he keeps sort of telling stories on himself and then saying, what a putz. Like, he dropped out of the E Street Band before they toured Born in the USA, you know, and he made these like bad decisions, you know, for his career, or decisions that he clearly is holding on to and regretting. And I was like, but you know, you still are in, you know, what a lot of people consider, you know, the greatest or one of the greatest American rock bands of all time. You're a featured player in, you know, a key person in what a lot of people think is the greatest television series that ever aired, The Sopranos. You have this satellite radio station where you could play whatever you want, and your taste is totally like it reflects your taste 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you have a record label that you could put out whatever you want, and then you could play the stuff on your satellite radio station, and you sped the end of apartheid. So that sounds requited to me. Like, it sounds like you requited a lot of your infatuation. I said that to him, and he's like, well, you know, but I can't, like, you know, play a theater, you know, like all the theaters I want with my band. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, did pretty well.
That's
like,
funny.
It was a lesson for me too. And it's like, no matter who you talk to, there's always like the regret of what didn't happen or what didn't work or whatever. And it's hard as a person to look back and be satisfied, I think, especially if you're an artist, because artists, like, by nature aren't satisfied. And, you know, and I credit Steve Van Zandt for not going around taking a victory lap. But I also felt like, I don't really know you that well, but I'm just going to say, I'm impressed. I think you've done a lot for the world. And, you know, I hope that at some point you could look back on that and be like, damn, that was all really great, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think 3 years of Caro Pop is a really good thing. So you should be really happy with that. So how did you even get the idea to do a podcast called Caro Pop anyway?
So the thread on it is, I did all these interviews, especially at the Tribune, and I liked doing long interviews. I liked talking to someone for like an hour. And I missed it because I left the Tribune. I took the buyout at a point where a lot of people took the buyout. And I didn't take it because I was frustrated with the Tribune. I just sort of thought, I keep writing about people who take creative risks. It's time for me to take some creative risks. So I'm going to try to write some stuff that isn't newspaper articles. I'm going to try to do some projects that aren't for the paper. And I had a movie series that I've been wanting to do forever. And I did it for like 2 years at the Music Box called Is It Still Funny?
Yeah.
Where you just show old movies that were comedies and then you just see if they were still funny. And then I'd lead a discussion and you'd score them and stuff. But like seeing Animal House or Blazing Saddles in, you know, a theater of 250 people is different from watching it on your couch where it's never as funny. Anyway, I did that. And then I started, and then I thought, I really miss doing these interviews. And I'd done some also for the Tribune. They had the Chicago Live series, and I'd done a bunch of interviews. I talked to Jesse Eisenberg, the actor, at an event at Spertus Museum not long before I left the Tribune. And I'd done a lot of them. And I talked to Billy Corgan at Ravinia as part of one. And
like in front of an audience?
Yeah, in front of an audience. And I liked it a lot. And so the Club Space, where you have had some wonderful shows, is in my, you know, neighborhood. And I went in there and I said, I'd love to start sort of like, if you have any like spare like Mondays where like no one's going in, I'd love to do some live on stage interviews. And so I started a series called Mark Caro's Talking in Space. And it would just be me on stage interviewing someone. And I did a few of them. The first one I did was with Chris Jones, the theater critic of the Tribune, is someone who I know very well. And so it was a definitely high comfort level for that. But I talked to Nora Dunn, who's since been on Caro Pop too, who's a wonderful actress and was on Saturday Night Live and has like really great, smart observations about all this. And also has been in a lot of movies.
Oh, she's hilarious.
And she's fantastic. And I had on Len Casper, who was debuting his band. So his band, Sonic 45, which was then called the 45, their first ever performance was at the end of my interview with him.
Oh.
He brought them all on afterwards. And then I had John Lankford on. And then I was going to have David Pasquese on. And then the pandemic hit. And we were sort of like realizing this was going to take a while. I talked to the guys at Space and I said, you know, maybe I could do Talking in Cyberspace and I could continue it and we could sort of put it on, you know, we could sort of make it a Zoom thing. And they're like, you know, if you want to do that, great. But, you know, we've got our hands full just keeping the club alive.
Right.
And the more I thought about it, the more I thought,
you don't need them for that.
Well, it wasn't that I don't need them. I would have happily sort of involved them in it. And I would have happily done anything to support them. And I did other things to try to support them. Yeah. And I still have all this like space glassware that I bought because, you know, just the little things. But, you know, I love space. And I've done a couple Caro Pop events there since. But I thought, I'm already like, it didn't take me long to go from I've never experienced Zoom in my life to, I don't want to be doing so much Zoom.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I'm talking to someone, they don't need to see me talking to them and they don't need to see the other person. And if the other person isn't on camera, maybe they'll feel a little more comfortable because they're not trying to look a certain way.
Sure.
So let's just keep it audio only. And that puts it in as a podcast. And that's basically how.
Are you a podcast fan?
Like, no, podcast that you- no. And I'm a total hypocrite on it because I'm really like not that much of a, cause like when I listen to stuff, it tends to be music, honestly. But there are a lot of podcasts. I mean, there are podcasts that I really like, and there are some really cool ones out there. And I probably should do some like cross promoting with some of them because, you know, there are ones where I think that we're sort of on, you know, similar wavelengths. But no, it was just sort of, I just was going to do this. And I had a blog called Pop Machine at the Tribune. And I thought I had the domain of popmachine.com or .net or whatever it was. And it turned out that it had expired and we didn't realize it. And some music company was using it. And there's another music company using Pop Machine. And I'm like, you know, if other people are using Pop Machine, I can't keep using Pop Machine. And so I was trying to come up with a name for it. I'm like, well, nobody's going to ding me on Carol Pop. You know, if I just got it's, and it's three syllables is good. It's catchy.
You wrote the theme song.
Yeah. I recorded the theme song because I was using, you know, at Space, you know, sometimes I would use like, Billy Preston's Out of Space to introduce me, but I didn't want to sort of figure out how I could license it. So I just wrote and it sounded like, honestly, I'm due to reinvigorate that theme song. And I was thinking either I should write and record a new one that maybe doesn't sound quite so sub-devo, or I should have like a contest where I'm like, anyone who wants to cover the Carol Pop theme, I will send you the full, I'll send you the full file. It's like a 3-minute song. And, you know, you could do it on piano and make it sound like, you know, Linus's like theme like or whatever. I don't know, whatever. Or I could just write something else. But anyway, so that was how it started, was me wanting to keep doing long interviews and not being able to do it because of the pandemic. And realizing that with Space, you know, you have to make sure someone's in town. You have to make sure that they have a free night and all this stuff. I mean, I did one with Michael Shannon last summer and it was fantastic, you know, and I did one with David Pasquazi, who was going to be my, you know, the last of the Talking in Space ones before the pandemic. And then we had to not do that. So he was wonderful too. And I need to schedule some more of those, but that was where it came out of, is just me liking these long conversations with people.
Wow. And it's turned into this whole thing that's really, really good.
I thought also, by the way, because I, you know, at the Tribune, I really did like, you know, a little more movies than music, but I did a lot of movies and a lot of music. It sort of depends on when you caught me. There were times where I was doing more music than movies. But I really thought it would sort of be split between movie people and music people with some chefs and authors thrown in. And that was my concept. And the pop was pop culture, not like necessarily pop music.
It's very heavily music.
And there are a few reasons for that. One reason is, the main reason is that I was sort of able to get musicians and sort of connect with musicians. And, you know, a lot of them you could just sort of go to directly. And they, you know, whether we're, you know, it, like Bruce Thomas and I were Facebook friends, even though he's the basis for Elvis Costello and the Attractions, you know?
Yeah.
And I sent him a note and he agreed to do it. Richard Thompson had a book that had been out for a while and it's a wonderful book. And I didn't interview Richard Thompson before. So I got him. So I was able to get these music people and they were really great guests. And when I tried to get the movie people, the problem is that like the whole movie publicity machinery is much more complex.
Yeah.
Like music is all about like albums and tours and stuff, but there's a lot of downtime in between, but actors are trying to go from project to project to project. And so you'll be like, oh, my publicist doesn't want me to talk about something now. Can you wait until September when this movie comes out? But then when the movie's coming out in September, they're trying to get everyone they can. And they're like, oh, you could have 10 minutes. And so the access to the movie people has been less good. And also because there's so many movie people who are just like on projects, they maybe don't want to burn as many bridges as Steve Berlin is willing to burn talking right. about Paul Simon, you know, on, and when Los Lobos got, you know, apparently, you know, ripped off by him for credit for, you know, Graceland. And, you know, that's a story he's told and he's candid about it. And just in general, like, I've just been so impressed with how kind of vulnerable and candid, you know, a lot of the musicians yeah. have been. And I've just, and I love talking to musicians, as you know. I mean, you and I wrote a book about songwriting
yes.
And I love doing that. And I like taking those sort of similar tacks with musicians. And it's not like I don't like actors, but I think that there's more of an acting element in it. But I've had some really good ones. I mean, I had Jane Lynch.
Yeah.
And the way I got Jane Lynch was that I'd interviewed Suzzy Roach of the Roaches, and Jane Lynch sent me a note on Twitter saying how much she loved
the
Suzzy Roach. And so I just wrote back to her. I said, thank you. And then I said, you know, if you ever want to do an episode, I'd love to talk to you too. And she's like, that would be great. So she was my 100th episode last year, but that's how that happened, you know. And Judd Apatow, I've interviewed a bunch of times, and, you know, he was totally gracious and nice to talk to me as well. So I've had some of those, and they've been fantastic, but I just don't have the sort of access to the film people quite as much. So yeah. Thank you, Steve, for turning the tables on me.
Yeah,
did you learn anything?
So much.
What's your biggest takeaway?
Well,
what surprised you the most?
That you're a science mind, not a art mind.
I'm
that
both.
You didn't go to journalism school.
No. Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's it for episode 150 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Steve Dawson for interviewing me and prompting me to ramble on like that. Steve, you've got a future in this podcasting thing if you want it. The website for Steve's and my songwriting book, Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You, is still up. So if you go to thebridgesongwriting.com, you can order and read about the book. You also can buy it on Amazon or ask about it at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music. And you really should check out Steve's new album, Ghosts, out now on Pravda Records. Then work backward, because he has a ton of great music to discover. Go to stevedawsonmusic.com to learn more about his music and his October East Coast tour dates with his wife, Diane Christensen, another supremely talented singer and artist. All 150 episodes have been produced by Chris Swake, who puts the pop into Carol Pop. If you've gotten this far, you must like Carol Pop, right? Any chance you can support us? For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. We appreciate you all, and I'll read the names of everyone who donates on the next episode. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.